Okay, let's get started. I'm Janelle Monk. I will be the moderator today. I'll introduce Terry Kester, who is a friend of mine. He's a man of great talent and passion. We're in the same ward. So I've known he and his wife Jan for a while. You can see that he does a great many things in his life from the description in the program. And he also is a host to the Peace Show on the Pacifica radio channel here in D.C., 89.3 WPFW, Wednesday, 11 a.m., The Peace Show, and that's Terry. And second, we have Nancy Cater. Nancy and I have been in the same study group a couple of times. I know she's a woman of great insight and passion about just about, you know, everything. And she is finishing her dissertation. Actually, she said she's finished her dissertation, and it is handed in and pending. So I'll be interested to hear about that. Bonner Ritchie, when I was at BYU, he was an organizational behavior professor there, and I seem to remember some controversy in the 80s while I was there. I told him I was a fairly conservative person at the time, so I didn't pay a lot of attention, but he said someone described him actually a sheep in wolf's clothing. So that's probably true. And so we have quite a good panel here. We'll give them each 15 minutes, and I will keep you on time. I'm told to be a little strict about it. And then we'll give you some time to respond to what your fellow panelists have said, and then we'll open it up for quick Q&A for everyone. Terry.
Well, good morning, all, and thank you for being here. And I saw a number of people moving and shifting, some leaving, so I guess they're opposed to peace. But, hey, it's all right. I'm Terry Kester, and I do encourage you to listen to my radio show. I will plug that if you're here in the area, Wednesdays at 11 a.m. We solve all the world's problems in half an hour, which is, you know, not easy, but we've managed to do it. It's a good show. We have great calls, et cetera. Anyway, in case you weren't aware of it, In our short history in America, you know, we've had about 9 declared and 135 undeclared wars. Not bad, huh? We're pretty busy. We spend today about $230 million a year on the Peace Corps. $230 million a year on the Peace Corps. We spend $974 million a day on the military. $230 million on the Peace Corps in a year. $974 a day on our military. We are not a peaceful people. We are not a peaceful nation, despite what George Bush says. I'm concerned particularly with the peace issues, particularly being a member of the Mormon Church. I find a great deal of conflict and contradiction between what I understand as Christianity and our war activities. And I'm not going to debate today, and maybe my other panelists will. I'm not going to debate or talk about necessarily the issues of the war itself that Bush has just acclaimed victory over. To me, they're self-evident. If you've studied the situation at all, the war is an atrocity. While maybe some action has been necessary, the action that we've taken, but I won't go into all that. I'm going to stick with what my theme is, which I consider to be, how does a Christian respond to war? Does a Christian respond to war? How does a Mormon respond to war? You know, as a child growing up just outside Chicago and just outside St. Louis, I attended every Sunday first a Methodist church, then a Presbyterian church. And I was always struck, even as a young kid, that Jesus Christ just might have meant what he said. This is frightening, very frightening. It's a thought that most Christians, I dare say, the overwhelming majority of Christians, from Paul to most LDS leaders, simply do not want to face, in my opinion. I refer, of course, to the astounding context of Christ's teachings, that context being the revolutionary, unworldly propositions, one, that we are not to judge, two, that we are to love our neighbors even when they are our enemies, three, we are to forgive and 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 forgive 7 times 70, no matter how unendurable our forgiving seems to be, and four, that it is the peacemakers, the meek, the humble, the quiet, the lowly, not the warriors, not the heroes, not the generals, not the presidents, not even the prophets that are to be blessed. I'm going to leave to God the astounding, truly sacred role of defining or explaining or revealing Christ's divine birth, his achieving or perhaps always possessing divinity, his sacrifices, his atonement, his resurrection. I leave that to God. I may believe, my faith may sustain me, I may even testify, but I cannot explain my faith, my belief. No man can. I join Thomas Jefferson, and quoting from a letter of his to John Adams in 1803, we should all then, like the Quakers, live without an order of priest, moralize for ourselves, follow the oracle of conscience, and say nothing about what no man can understand. The problem begins when we, in our vanity, even while remembering that all is vanity, go beyond Jefferson's advice, beyond Christ's doctrines, beyond his teaching, beyond his context. The problem begins when we in our vanity hie to the teachings of men. I'm going to quote you a couple more things from Thomas Jefferson, letters that he also wrote. Of all the systems, and I think Jefferson has a profound and a perspective on this, and one that I would certainly agree with. Of all the systems of morality, ancient or modern, which have come under my observations, none appears to me to be so pure as that of Jesus. That's Thomas Jefferson in a letter to a Mr. Canby. Later on, he then writes rather the astounding observation, and this is a letter to a Mr. Short, that Paul was the first, the great Corpheus, and the first corrupter of the doctrines of Jesus. He's speaking of course, Paul in the Pauline doctrines. He continues on in another letter to Jared Sparks, the metaphysical insanities of Athanasius, of Loyola, and of Calvin are to me, to my understanding, mere lapses into polytheism, differing from paganism only by being more unintelligible. We could apply that to a few leaders I've read. And finally, had the doctrines of Jesus been preached always as pure as they came from his lips, the whole civilized world would now have been Christian. Thomas Jefferson. As soon as we go beyond the mark of Christ's incredible context, revealed in parable after parable, in missionary experience after missionary experience, we at the very least create contradiction. We sow confusion, we fuel controversy, and in so doing we deny, and in so doing then the next step is we deny the contradictions that we've just sown, declaring ourselves uniquely revealed to, and we finally and faithfully anoint ourselves, putting the beautiful, peaceful, loving God of Christ aside. Now, with the context of Christ aside, now anointed, now we are free to make war. Now we are free to justify. Now we are free at last to take innocent life. For is not the inevitable consequence and therefore the essential definition of war, of conquering, of invading, of bombing, the inevitable taking of inevitably innocent life? Isn't that war's primary activity? Once we go beyond Christ's morality, Christ's instructions, once we allow the scriptures of history or myth or prophecy or of revealed interpretation or translation to achieve equal weight to his magnificent world-changing doctrine, we open both Pandora's and Satan's box of confusion and horror forever. We open the doors wherein we can find that which we can't find in Christ's teaching, the right, the permission, the sanctification, to do anything we want to do, whenever we want to do it, or whenever George Bush feels the need to do anything he wants to do. As members of the Church of Jesus Christ, we have extended the confusion further than most. We even ignore our own teachings. 2 Nephi 32:3, wherefore I say unto you, feast upon the words of Christ, for behold, the words of Christ will tell you all things that ye should do. And verse 6, behold, this is the doctrine of Christ, and there shall be no more doctrine given after he shall manifest you unto you in the flesh. No more doctrine until he shall manifest himself unto you in the flesh. They took away my mic. I must be too loud. That's all right. It's been said of me before. Okay. At any rate, when he shall manifest himself unto you in the flesh, the things which he shall say unto you, you, not someone else, not anyone else, the things he shall say unto you, shall ye observe. It's on page 115 of the Book of Mormon. 312 pages later, Christ appears to those people, not you or me, but to those people, and he teaches them the same doctrines of love and peace that he taught and lived in the New Testament. Yet we ignore our own instructions from 2 Nephi earlier and use all of the other stuff in all of the hundreds of pages before and all of the thousands of pages since and all of the thousands and millions of pages to come. We use them and apply them equally to the simple, world-shattering teachings of Christ. Now, I'm not disputing the value of nourishing mother load of ideas in all other scriptures, or in our own personal recorded revelations, or in other treatises, including my own. I am saying weigh them. Use them at least in the careful comparison to the context of Christ's beautiful and, in my view, sacred teachings. And if you do that, I defy you to find justification for war. Any war. I challenge you, particularly those of you here in Washington, D.C., I don't know how many we have here, but so many people in D.C. who flock to and push your government towards careers in what I consider a corrupted government and a shock and awe imperialist military, to at least recognize our own doctrines. And here I specifically refer to Satan's claim in our temple ceremonies that it is he and he alone who raises armies and navies and wages war. Why are we taught that? And then why do we proceed to go out and join armies and navies and wage war? We're not listening to our own doctrine. And as to the evil that we do encounter as a people or as a nation, that evil is sufficient unto the day. Do what Christ teaches us to do. Stand up to it. Identify it in every case wherein you encounter it. Be a whistleblower. Take the risk and suffer the consequences as Christ did. Accept the pain and the fear, but do not be the one who inflicts the pain and the fear. This is what Christ asked of us. This is what he teaches us, begs us to do. And yes, it requires more courage and more faith than any soldier ever dreamed of. And yes, it requires more than I and more than any human being can really do, but it is at the very least where I must begin my Christianity. Remembering, as I am afraid, as I lack the necessary faith and the necessary courage, that it is, after all, Christ's battle and that he is capable where I am not. And so finally, if I find myself in war, if I find because I cannot find a way that I must go to war, at least if I'm going to call myself a Christian, if I'm going to at least try to be a Christian, I at least must have the courage to not to pretend that what I am doing is God's will. At least have the Christian honesty to ask for God's forgiveness, not his blessing. And if we choose to set aside the profound context of Christ's message, how are we different from any other people and any other vengeful religion? We are the same, and we are warmongers. As I said in the beginning, as a child, growing up first just outside Chicago, then just outside St. Louis, at Sunday, Methodist, then Presbyterian Church, joining the Mormon Church many years later, I am still struck that Jesus Christ just might have meant what he said. Thanks. Questions? Challenges? I'm sorry? Okay. Okay, save those questions. All right, that sounds good to me. Would you like some more of Thomas Jefferson?
No, but it's hard to compete with a radio host. What a voice and a manner. That's very, very beautiful. All right, well, you know, I don't think any of the three of us here disagree about the sort of big picture, which was we didn't agree with this war. But I'm taking a very different angle or a different position because I'm against using Christianity, using God, or using the scriptures, or using any religious reasoning at all to make up your mind about how you should confront issues such as the war. To do so makes us weak in the sense that there's many positions that Christians take, and it also makes us similar to the radical Muslims and radical Jews. Radical Muslims use the Quran to justify their violent acts, even though you could certainly argue whether their scriptures contain those kinds of justifications. Radical Jews use the scriptures, certainly the Old Testament, to justify their radical acts, such as occupying and destroying Palestinian culture. I take the position from a local rabbi, Jack Moline, over in Alexandria, who said recently, there are three ways to use scripture. There's text, there's context, and there's pretext. And I think too often people who try to use religion use pretext. But not you. I thought you. So I advocate the use of reason, international law, diplomacy, moral philosophy, the tools that God has granted us in our own brains to work together, to come together to make good decisions. And I believe that they're superior. The most well-known international law that we have right now to help us determine whether there's a moral basis for any kind of war is on the handout I just gave you. It's called Just War Theory. Many of you know about it. Some of you may not. Just war theory does have a Christian basis. Just war theory was begun by Augustine, and could be no more Christian person, obviously, than St. Augustine. But even he recognized that just taking a blanket position wasn't helpful because every case, every situation is different. So he began to develop what he considered norms. These norms, even though they have a Christian basis, are certainly not considered Christian nowadays. They're taken as an international gold standard. One thing that's very interesting to know is that, at least I've been told, that Bush 1, the father, carried a little card with these conditions in his pocket during the first Gulf War. And that was one of the reasons he didn't persist in going all the way to Baghdad, was because he felt that it would be somewhat of a violation of the conditions of war. Before I say, I'm going to say just another brief thing about those, but before I do, I want to say that I also do not believe that taking a position of pacifism is logically consistent. I do believe in selective pacifism. In other words, I think that there's times when a person might choose to be a pacifist in a certain war or in a certain situation. I believe that certainly, you know, one might advocate peace in any way you can. But I don't think that, I think the whole point of a nation state is to protect us in some sort of self-defense. And so I do think there are times when war is defensible and war might have some kind of meaning. And I don't think it's logical that there is not. On the other hand, how I really support pacifism is as a tactic. I think it's a tactic, not a position. So for instance, the use of pacifism by Martin Luther King, the use of pacifism by Gandhi, obviously were wonderful tactics and helped advance their cause. And I certainly believe that we should use it as war protesters every chance we get. History does show mixed success, however. Pacifism sometimes is very effective in the ones I mentioned, and sometimes in the few cases where the Palestinians have tried it, they've basically been shot. So it's not always very helpful. Now, to the problems with this war, if you, those of you who have this sheet, I think that it's very quickly, easily to point out, I'm sorry I didn't leave one up here for you, my fellows to look at. I'll hand you mine in a minute. The main problem we have with this war is that we don't have a just cause. Those of you who heard Omar speak last night, he pointed out that lately he, in a class of 200 people, he asked everybody to raise hands. Why did we go to war? And he got, I forgot, 13 different answers or something. And he couldn't get votes for anybody to agree. So I suspect if I did that here, I'd hear a lot of different answers from you all. You know, we know of the weapons of mass destruction. We know some people think it's oil. Some people think it's just to, you know, force our new strength upon the Middle East because of 9/11. I mean, there's many possible reasons. But the point is, it's not clear, whereas in Gulf War I, at least we had a reason, which was that they were invading Kuwait, and we could all state that reason whether we agreed with it or not. In this war, we don't have a clear reason. Number three, we don't know what the intention is. We don't really understand the motivation of this administration. We don't know. There's certainly, I think, a feeling among those of us who are bothering to even listen to this talk. What Bush's story changed as he got into it, right? It was this, and then it was that. The whole weapons of mass destruction thing sort of evolved, you know. And Colin Powell's, even though his speech was well-received, none of it's turned out to be true. The evidence that he produced, now that we're in the war and we went to all the places he said, none of it has panned out. None of it. So we don't really understand their intentions. So, and one more thing, the last resort, number five, all peaceful alternatives must be exhausted. We all know we certainly didn't exhaust peaceful alternatives. So those are the logical reasons why I was against this war. Now, if you want to consider applying these sort of requirements against other wars, I think it's easy to see that if you think of wars that are accepted, World War I, World War II, and everything, they pretty much meet these kind of conditions. If you think of the most famous war in our history that was not accepted, Vietnam, it has the same problems. We don't know why we went to that war. We don't understand the cause. We don't understand the motivation. We don't understand the proportionality. It didn't fit these requirements, and therefore it's a war that is still not accepted. We can also ask why it is that if we do think we had the right motivation and the right cause, then why are we alone? Why is it that no other nation, you know, to speak of, was willing to sign on with us? And I think for the same reason, they don't understand our cause and our motivation as well as our proportionality. Now, on the other hand, I'm going to say something negative about my list, even though I just supported it. Is the list sufficient? Well, not necessarily, because there's always, with anything, interpretation problems. Some of you might say, you know, well, what does you really mean by last resort? How far do you have to go? You know, do we have to have weapons inspectors for 2 decades? I mean, you know, everybody can differ on how we interpret, you know, whether we've gone through everything we need to do. On self-defense, for instance, most people would argue that self-defense is a perfectly sound reason for war, but at the same time, we differ on whether what self-defense is, if it's a perceived threat rather than a real threat, which the current Baghdad war was put up to us as a perceived threat. So, number one, whenever there's a perceived threat, we don't really know how to act. Secondly, is preemption a reasonable response to a perceived threat? And again, we did preemption. Many of you might be old enough to remember Israel's Six-Day War, in which they used preemption against the Arabs. It's still very controversial, because even if the Arabs had attacked them the next day, as we've seen over and over again, the Arabs don't have sufficient and strong enough to do anything but generally run a day or two later. Many people feel that that form of preemption was satisfactory and turned out, but I would argue that we've had several decades now to see that it didn't solve their problem. Israel is just as unsafe and in as much trouble as they were then. Nobody knows for sure, you know, or I should say nobody agrees for sure exactly on every interpretation of just war theory, which is why we sit in the world today with still confusion. I just want to quickly say that there's two more simple ways to examine any moral problem, and I think many of you know through common sense what they are. The first one is, what is the person's motive? And the second one is, what are the consequences? So if you look at war by motive, which is, you know, what are our intentions? What do we intend to accomplish? Then that's one way you gauge, you know, whether this is morally appropriate. The second way is, how did it turn out? Was the loss of life worth what you actually gained? On those kind of questions, you don't know right off the bat. Certainly right now, we're all cheering just a little bit because we're happy that the war is over, and we're happy that so few Americans got hurt. But I contend that it'll take at least, you know, a few years, if not many years, before we really see the total fallout in the Middle East and how this is going to actually, what kind of consequences this has. It may turn out right, and if it does, then we may say that war was worth it after all. Perhaps those of us who were worried about it were somewhat wrong. Now, just on a very quick question, can terrorism then sometimes be justified? Surprisingly enough, or maybe not surprising to some of you, I'm going to say yes, it can sometimes be justified. And even in moral theory, there are some lists of reasons when you can justify terrorism. One of them is the group legitimate in the sense of, does it represent a large group of people rather than just a clutch of people? Does it have their assent in some sort of supportive way? Does the group have a geographical basis? Is this just a group of, you know, weirdos like perhaps the Baader-Meinhof gang were in Germany, or is this a whole nation state like the South Africans, you know, who were oppressed? Are their aims clear and negotiable? Do they have goals that they're trying to negotiate? Do they have an identifiable cause? Did they try some reasonable means and were they rejected? Do they have a disadvantaged position? In other words, is somebody actually oppressing them? And when you go through all those situations, you'll find out that some kinds of terrorism might be morally acceptable. Or at least we might say that those of us who are in that position might use it. And in that comparison, I find, for instance, Osama bin Laden's actions to be not defensible. I don't see what his geographical position is. I don't really understand the group that he intends to support. We never saw him intend to do any negotiations with us or state goals that we can work with. Whereas the PLO under Yasser Arafat has a very clear basis. They're reasonable goals. They want a place to live in peace and freedom, so forth. So I support that. Some of the terrorism that's been done under the rubric of the PLO. What I do find cynical is the use of the word peace when it is meant in a very, let's just call it a vague and sort of, foo-foo way. we all want peace. Of course we want peace. Shouldn't the Palestinians want peace, for instance? Shouldn't the Israelis want peace? But if what peace means, for instance, to the Palestinians, is quit your suicide bombing, quit your fighting, and just put up with the oppression that you're under, well, of course, then nobody wants that kind of peace. Nobody wants peace under the situations where your life is miserable. And, I actually read a couple of quotes in the paper lately where, for instance, the Palestinian radicals insist on preventing Israel from making peace. I thought, isn't that an interesting thing? Israel is trying to make peace through occupying their homes and having guns on them. They can't go to the grocery store or the hospital. Or it's time for Israel and Palestine to work together to make peace. What does that mean? You know, what we want is justice, right? And if you have justice, then hopefully peace will follow. So I'll end by saying our desire for religious answers is basically a desire for an overall conscience. We're looking for somebody to give us a hand here on these very tough problems. And I find that worrisome because I find religion is often a way that we try to instill our values in others, whether the values are coming from Saudi Arabia or from Salt Lake. And perhaps that's because I've often been on the liberal side, standing against war. So even though I would hope that a Christian would be more thoughtful like Terry is, I don't have faith that the church itself is going to make that statement. I think that I'd like to just end with a quote from Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. Has anybody watched Comedy Central? Jon Stewart the other night, I guess this was the day that the statue of Saddam Hussein was pulled down. So some of you might have heard this. Jon Stewart said, if there's anybody out there right now who isn't affected by this, doesn't feel a little tear in their eye to think and hope that these people are now free of a tyrannical despot, then you're so lost to the ideological left that you're not even worth talking to. But at the same time, aren't just a little concerned about how did we get there? Why are we in this war? What are our goals? What in the world are we doing? Then you're so lost to the ideological right that there's no use talking to you. So I think that's the stance that we all should take. Thanks.
Thanks, Terry and Nancy. I'm delighted to share my frustrations and ambiguous values with you today. 45 years ago, I found myself in Germany, in Berlin. I was in Berlin when the wall went up. as an Army officer in command of a nuclear weapons unit. And we armed our weapons to blow the Soviets and the East Germans off the map. And as we moved from Helmstedt to Berlin during the late 50s, early 60s, I remember thinking, geez, this is scary. This could be serious. Yeah, I was a young, naive sort of person that was trying to confront a complex reality and didn't quite know how to think about it. As a result, I became very disillusioned with my field and went back to school to try and understand people. It's a continuing quest. I haven't got there yet. And as a result, I struggle with the notion of power, of leadership, of conflict, and have spent a professional lifetime trying to deal with those things. And I'm still terribly troubled by the way people think and talk. Just three quotes from yesterday's newspaper. From a person, a reporter in Baghdad, quoting an Iraqi cleric who was condemning what he was doing. Said, Saddam was an Arab. We accept him. Americans are not from our religion. We reject them. You know, it's a pretty simple philosophy, kind of an interesting sort of value system. And then from Jay Garner, who's supposedly making the peace, he says, we ought to be beating our chest every day. We ought to look in the mirror and be proud and stick at our chest and suck in our bellies and say, damn, we're proud we're Americans. You know, that didn't inspire me, frankly. A little troublesome in terms of a quote from somebody who's supposed to be doing some pretty important things in Iraq. And a third quote I find really interesting. USA Today is not my source of truth, but it's always a good source of conversation. It says that if you object to homosexuality on moral grounds, as Senator Rick Santorum recently did in an interview, you may not be swayed by an economic argument. But if you are impressed by economics and entrepreneurship and growth and economic success, you ought to listen to this issue. There's a high economic price to intolerance. The key of understanding America's technological and economic vibrancy lies in our openness to new people and ideas. Tolerance of immigrants, gays, and other minorities is the most important variable in sustaining economic growth. Far more important than President Bush's tax plan. This is an editorial article, obviously. But they rated areas of the country in terms of economic success and economic progress, creation of jobs and so forth, at a time when jobs are not being created at a very high rate in our country, and found that those correlated very nicely with areas of philosophical, religious, and other forms of diversity. And, of course, the number one area is the San Francisco Bay Area, which is my home. And then Miami and Atlanta and San Diego, Washington, D.C., Orlando, L.A., Austin, and Las Vegas. Anyway, the notion of diversity, of ideas, of values, of perspectives generating the climate for development. It's kind of an interesting notion. Well, With my personal experience, I decided that my goal was to try and build bridges between cultures rather than beat them up. And so I changed my field and went back to school and pursued a little different direction. And as I reflect now, I'm concerned that we hesitate to build a science of peace. I've seen an evolution from an original paradigm of conflict resolution where our attempt was to resolve, or more particularly to suppress, the evidence of conflict, to a world of managing conflict, moving from conflict resolution to conflict management, where we learn to appreciate the diversity and appreciate the differences and manage the differences, manage the conflict, not suppress it or not try and overcome it, to a third paradigm of peacemaking or peace building. Instead of attempting to eliminate the emergent or the present conflict, we should engage in a world of building peace prior to the outbreak. Define conditions and mechanisms and procedures for eliminating the racism or for eliminating the injustice that Nancy talked about, for eliminating the variables that lead to that. The world is a very large system, and though that systemic process creates forces that are very destructive and that lead to an outbreak of a legitimate response from those who are oppressed or those who are victims, and then they strike back. But they do because of a condition that is imposed. And we can look back in history at colonial imposition. We can look back at a lot of forces that have led to that. The morning after 9/11, I was quoted in the paper as what my first response was. And while my first response was sadness and tragedy, my comment was that the United States sought to rethink its foreign policy. And I took more guff on that comment because it was assuming that I was blaming the United States. And I am. I'm absolutely blaming the United States for what I think is bad foreign policy. That does not justify Osama bin Laden's behavior. I'm in the same way that when I leave the gate open, the dog runs out and causes an accident, the drivers of the cars are responsible for causing the accident. But I could have made a difference by being more responsible and, you know, an attractive nuisance by closing the gate so a child does not fall in my swimming pool, or closing the gate so the dog doesn't run out and cause a problem. There is a level of responsible behavior that isn't a direct cause, perhaps in a proximate sense or in a legal sense, although it is a legal issue. But I think that in the larger sense, we did not develop a philosophy or a strategy or a concept of peace building. We've developed a concept that leads to that conflict, and particularly in our behavior with Israel and in the Middle East. I've lived in Jerusalem on four different occasions, and the first time I lived there, had an apartment close to Nablus Road leading north out of Jerusalem, and there wasn't a night that went by. This was during the first Intifada. There wasn't a night that went by that we weren't awakened by gunfire. And for the kids, that was a kind of brutal experience. There was a checkpoint not far from where we lived, and there were always confrontations and gunfire every night, reminding us of the brutality of an imposed order that destroys people's freedom. Well, anyway, in the process, by the way, an example comes out of that. I became acquainted with Rabbi Hartman in Jerusalem during that time, a very interesting and very impressive guy who defines his role in life as saving the Bible from the Jews and saving the Jews from the Bible. And in that process, his logic is that any religious text can be so misused that he has to save the Jews from that misuse of that religious text. And he also has to save the good, the pure, the valuable part, the ennobling part, from those who misuse. So we have to save people from the troublesome texts, and have to save the good texts from the troublesome people. And in that process, I agree. And another very telling discourse on that is Peter Moss's book, Love Thy Neighbor, where he looks at the Balkan conflict. And his inquiry is how friends can turn into enemies under the guise of Christian theology. And he has a very chilling and telling chapter where he talks about how we turn torture into entertainment, how we turn the suffering of others into a voyeuristic, entertaining life, how the most brutal conflict was not between Muslims and Christians, but between Orthodox and Roman groups, the Serbs and Croats, and how they would create a replica of the Roman Colosseum or arena and put two brothers or two friends in the arena, and they had to fight to death. You know, only by one of them killing the other could anybody survive. And that process of turning torture and violence into entertainment. And we have a remarkable capacity for doing that. That heart of darkness, that dark side of us that allows that to happen. And without the moderating and the cleansing aspect of a very, very powerful value system, we can turn into that sort of person. Well, in order to highlight that, let me read a few quotes. I would suggest two things for reading. I spent yesterday at the U.S. Institute of Peace, which is a rather remarkable organization here in Washington, and I've become very impressed with John Lederach, who is a Mennonite philosopher, scholar, mediator, and his book on building peace through the USIP.org, I think it is. But the U.S. Institute of Peace has done some very creative things, and primarily publications, but they have about 100 publications on current conflicts around the world, on mediation efforts, on peace-building efforts. And Lederach's book on building peace is a wonderful translation of what I think are very basic concepts of peace, generating points, generating accurate information, verifiable data, justice for all, trust in the system, a reasonable degree of freedom, not ultimate freedom, not absolute freedom, but a reasonable degree with options for jobs and school and so forth, a philosophy of reconciliation, of forgiveness, of being able to move beyond the gripes, the vengeance, the vindictiveness, and lastly, the transcendent metaphors, the more important things, something that matters more than victory or something that matters more than beating down somebody. I like the notion of the metaphors. I use often Anatole Rapoport's books on fights, games, and debates. As you move from a metaphor, he wrote that during the Cold War, as we should move away from a fight where you want to destroy to a game where you want to win, to a debate where you want to share and convince somebody else you're right. I think those three metaphors stop short. I add two more. I add a metaphor of love, where you care more about the other person, where you care more about their well-being. The first three are selfish. In a fight, I want to prevail. In a game, I want to win. I want to get more points than my opponent. In debate, I want to win by cunning and logic and verbal skills. But in love, you care about the other person's well-being, and you care about their worth rather than imposing yours. And then my fifth metaphor, is that of children. The virtue, the values, the caring about children, which is a metaphor of the future, making the world a better place for them rather than imposing your short-term power structure. Anyway, so with that metaphorical logic, we have a way of capturing that notion. Let me read from a book that I found very meaningful, Chris Hedge's book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Let me use a few quotes just in ending here. He says that war forms its own culture. The rush of battle is a potent and lethal addiction. War is a drug. Peddled by mythmakers, historians, political leaders, correspondents, filmmakers, novelists, all of whom endow it with qualities it does not possess. Excitement, exoticism, power, chance to rise above our small station in life, and a bizarre and fantastic universe that has grotesque and dark beauty. It dominates culture, distorts memory, corrupts language, infects everything around it. Even humor, which becomes preoccupied with the grim perversions of smut and death. Fundamental questions about the meaning or meaninglessness of our place in the planet are laid bare when we watch those around us sink to the lowest depths. War exposes the capacity for evil that lurks not far below the surface in all of us. That is why it is so hard for many of us to discuss. The enduring attraction of war is this. Even with its destruction and carnage, It gives us what we long for in life. Apologies. And war is an enticing elixir. It resolves us, it gives us a cause, it allows us to think we are noble. I find that very telling. I find that a very helpful insight in terms of understanding who we are. It says, there's little that angers or disenfranchises more than those who fail to exercise power yet reap the rewards of power. Those who fail to exercise power in the benefits of people and yet reap the rewards of it. It's Saddam. Despots can be understood or even tolerated, but parasites must be destroyed. Quoting a soldier, I would rather die in this conflict than go back to the routine of life. The chance to exist for an intense and overpowering movement, even if it means certain oblivion, is worth it. But obviously very stupid once the battle is over. Disproportionate violence against innocents is a way to make a statement. We, the U.S., leaves that calling card. Washington uses murder and corpses to transmit its wrath. We delivered such incendiary messages in Vietnam, Iraq, Serbia, Afghanistan. Osama bin Laden learned to speak the language of modern American war. It was Robert McNamara who first said in the summer of 65 that the bombing raids in Vietnam would send a message to Hanoi, and the thousands of civilians killed would be to the communists in Hanoi that we were serious. That's exactly Osama bin Laden's lesson. It's that part of war's perversity that we lionize those who make great warriors as they use the excesses in supposed self-defense. Look at the 1990s. 2 million dead in Afghanistan before the U.S. went in. 1.5 million dead in Sudan. 800,000 butchered in Rwanda. 500,000 dead in Angola. 250,000 dead in Bosnia. 250,000 dead in Guatemala. Liberia. Burundi. Algeria. You know, I find it interesting when we look at the Arab world, or we look at the Middle East, and we look at the thousands killed in Algeria, and it barely makes the news. As I talk to people, they hardly know about the thousands of massacres in Algeria. And the reason is it's Algerians killing Algerians rather than Christians and whites and Jews being the victims. And then in the conclusion of one of his chapters, he says, I wrote this book not to dissuade us from war, but to help us to understand it. We were humbled in Vietnam, purged for a while of a dangerous hubris, offered in our understanding and reflection about the war a moment of grace. We became a better country, but that has slipped. He says that we have forgotten that arrogance. As Reinhold Niebuhr aptly reminded us, the book is not a call for pacifism, but a call for forgiveness and repentance. And I find that a very telling kind of logic. So, I'm concerned that we don't confront the dilemmas, that we don't confront the contradictions, that we are so glib and that we are so easily impressed by the cutesy arrogance of talk show hosts that praise the war and that justify it in terms of victory. And I'm referring to Sean Hannity and Savage and a few people who assume that they have triumphed, or that the cause has triumphed because of the statue. As said, the most thrilling moment in his life was when the statue of Saddam came down. And what an empty life! What a tragic criterion for meaning! And that's what Hedges talks about in this book, as he tries to confront us with our assumptions and force us to deal with that cruel dilemma that we so often so easily resolve in the black and white logic of meaning and triumph and victory in a world that demands love and compassion and forgiveness.
Thanks to all of you. Can we take about 10 minutes for you to reply to what your fellow panelists have said, if you'd like to? Any of you? Because you were number one? Okay, take just a few minutes.
Well, I certainly appreciate all of the thought expressed by Bonner and by Nancy. And there's really not much that I disagree with at all. I learned a long time ago through my own violence that the reason we have war is because we love war. There's a wonderful movie, a World War II movie. I forget the name of it, unfortunately. It was Glenn Ford. And it's after some particularly horrendous, horrendous battle and millions of soldiers killed in the Second World War. And he's a captain. And he's talking to his colonel. And he's saying, why do we do this? Why do we do this? And it says, the soldier said here, because we love it. I know I have a friend who's a musician, a rock musician. And he became a rock musician after being in the Special Forces in Vietnam. Because being a rock musician was the only thing he found comparable to combat. And he's right. And you know, I've seen it and I've experienced it myself in fortunate ways and fortunate ways in the arts as well. I mean, there's an intensity, there's a thrill, there's a excitement. I mean, you just want those few moments in life where you're using every bit of your capacity, intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, everything is on the line when you're in a combat or in a truly violent situation. It's exhilarating. It's erotic. It's very attractive. And unless we have the sight, the Heinz foresight, to see that, we'll fall into that trap every single time. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. And if we deny that, we deny why we get in the war. So I very much agree with Bonner's observations on that. I don't know if there is such a thing as a just war. I think Augustine, sorry, is wrong. And I'm not a pure pacifist. That's not the point at all. I think it's where you begin. And that's why Christianity is so important to me as a philosophy, even maybe more so than as a religion. Because a religion I leave to, that's beyond my understanding in a sense, and beyond just being able to discuss. But as a philosophy, it's where you begin your day. How do you start your day? What do you want out of your day? You know, what do you want out of your life? What do you want out of your nation? What do you want out of your culture? Where do you begin? And if you don't begin with this love that Bonner was speaking of, if you don't begin with understanding that you're exactly like I am, you have the same fears, the same doubts, the same anxieties, the same lust, no matter how we express them, they're all the same. If we don't begin by understanding that I am you, you are me, neighbors, brothers, if we don't begin every day with that, then we're always going to fall into this erotic, compelling conflict and turn it into entertainment. Which we really have done in this century. I mean, it may be bad what the Croats and the Serbs are doing, but it's not as bad as what NBC, ABC, Fox, and all those others are doing. That's entertainment. I know. I'm in the business. I know how you edit tape. I know how you make things exciting, how you like things, how you phrase things. I know how they do that. It's a craft. It's a beautiful craft. It's the most entertaining showbiz we've got. War, isn't it good? And it's very frightening what's happening to our society. I think society has slipped terribly, terribly, because we've forgotten where we begin our day, where we begin our life, where we begin our foreign policy. I will make mistakes. I'm a human being. I will get enraged. I will make mistakes. I will respond to violence. I will be aggressive. I will do all these things I don't want to do. But at least if I begin my day, begin my thoughts trying to be what Christ talks about, not what the Bible, the Old Testament, the New Testament, but what Christ talks about, which is love, then I maybe have a chance to ameliorate some of that. And then at least maybe I have some right to ask for forgiveness. So I disagree with Augustine. Sorry. Sorry. Thank you.
Yes.
Let's just do questions.
Okay, let's just do questions. Thank you, Terry. Okay. Kirk, you had your hand up.
Yeah. I was particularly your comments, exercising the military option in Afghanistan.
Okay, the question is it the same for Afghanistan, essentially? Who would like to? Unfortunately, we've got the awkwardness of the mic, and you need to jump up to the mic.
Nancy should answer that.
Nancy.
Well, yes, I do think it was justified in the sense of should we do something in Afghanistan. Now, whether or not, the second part of my little handout talks about your how you handle the war itself once you're in a war. And I'm not so sure in all cases we've been appropriate there. But I think that under the circumstances of the terrorist attack and that's where the terrorists were, I think that we have a certain self-defense cause that's more clear. I think also, however, it's interesting that the polls show that something like 90% of the American people think that now that the bombers of 9/11 came from somewhere like Afghanistan. They don't understand that they were all Saudi Arabians, but Saudi Arabia is a friend of ours, so we're not doing anything to Saudi Arabia. Not that I think we should, but I mean, it just goes to show how mixed up, our values are. But in general, I do think that it was appropriate to do something in Afghanistan. How we're doing it right now, I don't think is appropriate.
Can I jump on that too?
It may surprise you. I mean, I agree also that it was justified, response initially. But it still doesn't answer the question of where we begin. Because, you were talking about terrorism. I mean, Osama bin Laden is a terrorist who was raised, trained, nurtured by the United States, and to some degree for a just cause, in one, trying to be free of Saudi Arabian atrocity, and two, certainly fighting in Afghanistan against the evil empire of Russia. So he fits some of our definitions as a legitimate terrorist. And again, I'm not justifying 9/11 at all. So I think our response in that given moment, I mean, if a guy comes up and, yes, attacks one of my colleagues here, I am going to do what I can to defend them. And I will jump in and try to do that. I am not a pacifist to that degree. But the question is, where did we begin? Where did we begin? And then again, even with that moment, when we're there, do we begin again with compassion? Do we begin again with love? Every day, every second, we have to ask, even if I have to punch you, I've got to ask myself, where did it begin?
I want to push that beginning even further. What gives rise to that? Why was U.S. foreign policy so troubling in terms of the Middle East, the Arab world, the Islamic world for so long that allowed that to happen? And also, why is the Soviet or the Saudi education system so vicious? I was in Saudi Arabia not long ago. And just before the attack on Baghdad started, and I was in Egypt. I was in Cairo when the attack started a few weeks ago, and talking with a group of Egyptian managers, executives, and it was interesting. In Saudi Arabia, they all wanted Saddam out. None of them liked Saddam. But many of the people we talked to wanted him out so that they could replace him with a fundamentalist Wahhabi kind of government and assumed that would be the outcome. And one of the curious things is, do we really want democracy in Iraq, or is that loaded jargon and American rhetoric? If we had a free and open election in Iraq, what kind of a government would we have? What would come out of that? And Omar's claim is that it would be a Shiite Taliban, and that's a very interesting sort of notion. Do we really want democracy? The fundamentalist. I don't like the term fundamentalist. It's an extremist position. It's not fundamental, suggests fidelity to some basic principle and value. It's an extremist sort of dimension, the Islamist sort of movement, the politicizing of Islam. The logic by which you impose, and that's scary. So do we really want democracy
It's a very troublesome sort of rhetoric question that we really need to push our assumptions. And I think that we've been lied to consciously and unconsciously many times about motives and means and the things that Nancy talked about in the underlying sort of direction. But going back, Karzai isn't in control of Afghanistan, and he may be the king of a city, but what are we doing in that larger sense? We pulled out a long time ago of Afghanistan. We defaulted in Iraq a decade ago in terms of Shiite and Kurd needs. We defaulted in Palestine. We defaulted in Central Africa. We defaulted in the Balkans. And in the preliminary sense, not what you do after the military victory, but in a sense of that peace building in the first instance. And I think that's where we are very vulnerable and at fault for not defining a moral foreign policy in the first place. Osama was bad. Saddam is bad. Lots of other people have been bad. Stalin was bad. We didn't attack Russia. Many people thought we should have, but we didn't, and they fell. So there is a larger context, and we need that debate. And it's not an easy answer, but yeah, I would like him out. But I honestly believe there's other ways we could have done it. Yeah, my proposal for Iraq, for example, years ago was to fly in plane loads of medical supplies and food and many of you may not know, there's a substantial Iraqi Mormon population in Jordan. There are a couple of branches in Jordan that have a lot of Iraqi, including an ex-officer of Saddam's Republican Guard, who's the branch president in the little branch in, where is it, in Hassan, up in northern Jordan on the Syrian border. And they all want Saddam out. They don't want Americans running Iraq, but they all want Saddam out. But this group has left. Most of them are professionals. They're the only ones that had the resources and the vehicle, the means to get out. And he blames the United States for the past more than the present. He said, we didn't do 1,000 things we could have done. And he says that if we had flown in the food and medical supplies and so forth, we could have built a very different foundation. You know, we're trying to build a foundation of Jacksonian democracy on a foundation of a divine right of kings. And we've got that contradiction in terms of democracy, freedom, virtue, moral development. And we have the wrong foundation logic into what we've done in the past. So I want to go back and change the past.
Okay. Two questions, one to Nancy about her challenge that terrorism is sometimes justified, and a second question about to Terry, whether self-defense war is justified.
Well, I know that we don't want to leave this meeting without me saying one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, right? So I'll just say that. Even the State Department, even the CIA has a hard time defining terrorism, right? I think we can agree on a few things. They spread fear, and they use secrecy to do so. It tends to be indiscriminate and random so that it's unpredictable. You don't know where it's going to happen. It's evasive. And the terror is used as some kind of coercive, it's not just terror for nothing. It's intended to coerce something out of somebody. I suppose the one place where most everybody what is bad is when civilians are targeted. Nobody wants civilians to be targeted. On the other hand, when oppressed groups target civilians, of course, they argue that in a sense it's self-defense because they themselves have been oppressed and targeted. In other words, so many of their civilians have been harmed. In the case of, the Palestinians, for instance, they list the number of their civilian dead who are children, and they add up the numbers and just by numbers say, look, the state is using indiscriminate terror and targeting of civilians. And so, what the terrorists don't have is the legitimacy of the state. And that seems to make all the difference, right? So I'm certainly not going to try to justify all kinds of terrorism, but I do think that if you just take a utilitarian standpoint, which I'm not a total utilitarian, but as Americans we kind of are, then you would measure it by the consequences. And what that would mean is if one act of terrorism actually brought peace. In other words, if you could assassinate the one person who's in the state who refuses to, you know, give in and negotiate, then maybe it would be worth it. Maybe, you know. It would... Yeah, well, because of course terrorism isn't exactly a war, you know, so you can't follow all, you know, you can't argue that exactly in this context. And I'm not saying that I would agree in a utilitarian sense that you could do that, but I'm saying a utilitarian would argue that it would be moral. In other words, the famous story of if you could have killed Hitler first, you would have saved the Jews, right? I think many of you right now would say, yeah, maybe that would have been worth it to kill Hitler. So in a terrorism sort of incident. So I do think that there's times that terrorism in that sort of context maybe could be defended morally. I do think that some groups would defend, for instance, the Basques as a group that uses terrorism in a moral way because they do bombings, but they make sure, they try very hard not to ever kill anybody. They use their bombings to scare, to show that they're there, to show that their geographical entity is threatened, and so on, but they don't kill people. I think you also have to distinguish the act from the cause to a certain extent. In other words, when Patty Hearst joined the SLA, do you all remember the Symbionese Liberation Army? There's a group of terrorists like, what did they want now? You know, can anybody even remember? You know, and Patty kind of got joined in with them, and she got her dad, you know, they sort of turned on her dad, and they got her dad was supposed to give all of his riches, his capitalist riches, to the poor, and he gave all this money to buy bread for, you know, poor people in San Francisco. And anyway, the whole thing was a little murky, you know. And I would say that who knows what their intentions and so forth were. If there's some kind of an underlying cause, I think we can all understand it more. And basically, I guess I would just say that if in your neighborhood another country decided to settle there, or let's not even say another country, another group, and they decided not only to settle there, but to kick you out of your house to do so, or to take over your backyard, or to separate you, put a checkpoint up so on your way to work you couldn't go, and so forth, I suspect that you would then find it perhaps morally permissible to take some kind of violent action to defend your property rights and your chance to live your life in freedom. So,
there isn't one terrorist supporter out there.
These are fascinating and difficult questions, and wouldn't it be nice, you know, if, as George Bush thinks, there's just good guys and bad guys, and, you know, you just gather outside OK Corral and you shoot it out, and eventually the good guy, because he's got a white hat, wins. I mean, if it were that simple, it would be a wonderful world. And, you know, even terrorism requires a community. You know, I mean, I used to believe that idea, well, if we just killed Hitler, we wouldn't have had World War II. I think it's nonsense. I mean, you know, Hitler didn't create Nazi Germany. Nazi Germany allowed for Hitler. You've got the community, you've got the unrest, you've got the suffering, you've got the anger, you've got all this stuff churning, and sooner or later, yes, somebody's going to stand up and say, let's use all of this angst, this anger, and let's use it to find some enemy and pick on them. I mean, it's always going to happen. And so the issue becomes to me, again, beginning, but where do you first attack terrorism? Well, you've got to help the Palestinians. You've got to help the Saudis. You've got to help the Afghanistan people. You've got to help the people of Rwanda. You've got to help the people of Nigeria. And this is all possible. This is financially, economically possible. I don't know, I hope you watch Bill Moyers Now occasionally. If you don't, I mean, you just can't be informed. You've got to watch Bill Moyers Now, you know, on Friday nights, 9 o'clock. He had an Indian woman on the other night talking about terrorism in India and talking about, you know, an American citizen, an ophthalmologist, an Indian ophthalmologist, who 6 days a week, he says, he gives he's Sikh. He gives to America, to his tax money and everything else, and supports America. And the seventh day, he gives money to Sikh terrorist groups. This is back in 1985. because there is oppression, because there are problems, because there are injustices. I mean, maybe you do have to have justice before peace. You know, so there's always a community for terrorism, so just picking it on one person and trying to shoot them isn't going to solve the problem. It's not a big enough view. As far as weapons of mass destruction, we're always involved with what the heck is the truth? And that's what we ignore every time we find a simple answer. There's a beautiful article in the Wall Street Journal, I forget the author, a couple of months ago, about the reality of weapons of mass destruction. It's bull! You can't take a jar of sarin or you know, biological stuff and disperse it and have any major tragedy unless you have a profound delivery system. The only weapons of mass destruction that are all weapons of mass destruction, the most effective is what's-his-name did in Oklahoma City. Get yourself some diesel fuel and a little fertilizer, drive a truck and blow it up. That's weapons of mass. And any weapon of mass destruction, be it or the nerve gas, the biological, cannot, will not produce any more damage than simple explosives.
That's right. High explosives are the most.
That's right. So all this hysteria we've been building is just simply not the truth. Now, yes, they will cause death. I'm not saying that. But like in the subway system in Japan, where they released, was it sarin or whatever it was?
Sarin?
12 people. 12 out of thousands. These aren't the horror that we've been taught. We've been taught fear, and we're thinking in terms of fear instead of thinking, what is the reality? So we've got to have truth first on what exactly is a weapon of mass destruction, what is the danger, how do I as a person deal with the danger, and then when you get down to preemption, you know, is there a case where you strike? No. Not unless I have so much incontrovertible evidence. I mean, don't we as people, as decent people, have to believe innocent until proven guilty, really? Don't we really have to start there? I know it's dangerous. I know I may walk out on the street and get blown up. But I have to start there. You know? And if we open this door of preemptive, I think you're guilty, I think you intend to hurt me, I think because indeed, you know, the two of you sitting next to each other have more physical strength than me, and you have glasses there that I don't have reach to, you know, that you can harm me faster than I could do anything about it. I can't act. I can't behave that way as a person, let alone as a nation. It's risky. But we have to start somewhere fighting for peace.
Let me add a couple of dimensions. I was teaching at Beer Sheva University, northeast of Jerusalem, and a student came to me and said he needed to talk to me. And I've had lots of students talk, and I've got answers for all these questions of problems. They can't turn in papers, can't take exams. They've got girlfriend or boyfriend or parent or children problems or health problems, and I've had all that. And this kid came and he said, my mother's been offered $50,000 for me to become a suicide bomber. What do you think? I've never had that before. And it was a very brutal kind of process. A young Palestinian student, one of eight children, father dead, a poor rural family. $50,000 is a lot of money in that context. Responsibility to take care of other children. It's security, it's education, it's a martyr, all kinds of variables. And the discussion was so interesting because I'd never tried to understand it from that standpoint. I'd never tried to see it. And that oppression that Nancy talks about, that frustration, that giving up in life. But another side of the evidence, I've taught at Beer Sheva three different times, a good Palestinian school just outside of Ramallah. And Omar doesn't think there's any good schools over there, but I think this is one of the better ones. I've been there during student elections, and the student political parties mirror the larger political parties of the culture, of the community. Hamas, Fatah, the communists, Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Islamic Jihad, they all run groups on the same platform as the larger political group in Syria or Lebanon or Palestine. And so with that campaign, with that logic, they are sort of polling the students in terms of their support for different groups. And when there are jobs, when there's opportunity, when the future looks reasonably good, as it did for a while following the Oslo negotiations, and Ramallah was becoming, American accounting firms were going in, there were banks, there were insurance companies, there were a lot of opportunities, the support for all of the extremist groups went down dramatically. Now, it didn't go to zero, but it went down to about 10 to 15%. While when things look bad, that kind of support for those groups goes up to about 50 or 60%. So we're talking about 40, 45% of the vote seems to be a swing vote. And that's my read of the community, of the larger context. So when the infrastructure is strong and when there's hope and future looks good, the support for the extremist and the terrorist goes down dramatically. There's still a little bit there, and you've got to deal with that small group. But by taking care of these other things, you eliminate 40, 50% of the support. And without that infrastructure support, it's very hard for the terrorists to function. It's very hard for them to get the mechanisms they need to do the work. And so that gives me some hope in terms of solving the peace building, solving these other problems prior to that kind of activity, rather than how do you punish it after it happens. Another perspective in Gaza. There are signs and bumper stickers that are very telling. They say green grass is a terrorist act. And you need to understand that. The Gaza Strip is the most densely populated area on Earth. 5 miles wide, 20 miles long, 1.3 million Palestinians and 4,000 Jewish settlers, Israeli settlers. The reason it's so densely populated is that the 4,000 Israeli settlers have 40% of the land in Gaza and 70% of the water, 4,000 versus 1.3 million. And water is, in case you don't know, a scarce resource in that world. And the olive trees and the fig trees and the tomato plants and the cucumbers desperately need water. And I have photographs that my wife has taken, and one is very telling. It's from a place in the road, an Israeli road. They have their own roads and their own military guarding the 4,000 people in the settlements in Gaza. And it's from an Israeli road looking one direction at the settlement, and which term Omar doesn't like. It's an illegal, immoral, evil occupation and theft of land. One is looking at the settlement, the other is looking at a Palestinian orchard. And the one looking at the settlement is green, it's the trees are producing, and everything is looking very pretty. And you turn 180 degrees and look the other way, and everything's dead. And the issue is very simple, it's water. And for 1.3 million people, that's real. And so that green grass is terrorism. And understand the emotion and the feeling that goes with that, and the need to strike back, the need to fight, the need to protect yourself. And that is a solvable problem. It's very easy. Close the settlements down. It should have happened ages ago, and that's a great breakdown. And if there is any justification in American foreign policy, the use of violence, it would be to send in the Marines and close down the Israeli settlements.
Have a few minutes left, so we can keep it to the questions.
I'll be very short. And I say this very cautiously because I rejected it myself. But to answer your question, I mean, my original thought that I was going to present a paper on in a talk here, and I say this cautiously, and I have rejected it. But it was Mormons, Future Fascist. And I am concerned, and this is part of the reason that I'm in this whole here today, is I am very concerned about what religion has become in this country. I'm very concerned about what Mormon religion has become in this country and about its fundamentalist or extremist, frankly, viewpoints, its self-justification, its self-righteousness, its blind obedience I am very concerned about that, and I think we should. And I agree with the other gentleman. You know, it really does begin at home, and it's hard not to get passionate about these things, and I know I overdo it sometimes. But, you know, we can make a difference in our church. We can make a difference in our wards. We can make a difference in our community. We can be as bold as Bonner and go beyond our community. I wish I had that courage. But we are in danger. We are in danger of becoming, and fascism is, you know, it's a nationalism gone berserk. That's what fascism is, nationalism gone berserk. Self-righteousness gone berserk. We're approaching that. We have a lot of work to do if we care. Thank you.